If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to Power Athlete Radio. Megan Young found her way to Seattle by becoming a strength and conditioning coach with the Sounders, the city's formidable MLS team. As a longtime strength coach for the Chicago Red Stars and the Auburn Tigers, she is no stranger to athletic development. But what particular challenges does the sport of soccer present for a performance coach, and how are the men's and women's games different? To find out, listen now. Here it is, episode 582.
Welcome to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Mr. McQuilkin, good to see you.
Well, I'm glad we took this show on the road.
I can't believe it. I mean, we got out in terms
Charles,
of...
you did it. Pat on the back.
Well, it's so weird. He just has a bunch of iPhones set up.
Don't give away our secrets. This is a giant production studio bunker that we whipped together.
It's so weird. I can't believe you broke into this place.
Don't.
Like, can you imagine Chris like going around just yanking on doors, and all of a sudden he like jimmies his room key in and is like, holy shit, it worked.
Don't ask how I found this. And even when I was texting Megan, I was like, we didn't exactly ask permission, so don't go asking a worker where this room is.
Well, the funny part is when she walked in when we were talking with Jim, at first I was like, oh God, I hope this isn't somebody that works at this hotel, like coming to boot us out. And then I was like, oh wait, that's our guest. Thank God.
Yes. Well, welcome Megan Young, performance coach with Seattle Sounders. Yep. That's new, right?
4 months, yeah.
4 months. Yeah. Awesome.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. So let's discuss that a little bit.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And more importantly, like give us some details.
Yeah. So 4 months with Seattle now, in the MLS side, I've worked within what I call world's football for about 15 years now. Before that, I was working as a high performance director for a women's team in Chicago. Chicago's Red Stars, the pro team there. So it was opportunity meets making my family happy. So it's like one of those things where now I get to be a part of what I consider a great organization, and people within the world of sport in America especially consider a really good organization. So you put me there, and I put my fiance in her happy place in Seattle. So it was a no-brainer. No, she did her. She's smarter than me. She did.
Sounds like my wife.
Yeah, she did. Good job. Yeah. She did her master's and doctorate work there. And so for her to get back there and feel like she's in her home, like that that's everything, you know? And then also professionally for it to make sense for me. And I get, the water is super important to me. So water in mountains and it's green. So in Chicago in the winter, everything kind of dies. In the Pacific Northwest, it just gets wet, but still is green. So sure. I'm down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, my mom's from Vancouver.
Oh.
And so like, oh yeah, like my whole family's from that part of the world. And so we spent a lot of time in Seattle. So I'm pretty familiar with it. It was kind of a little sad, like seeing all like the riots and everything on the news and being like, oh, I know where that is.
Yeah.
Oh man, they killed that place, but, it looks like it's coming back.
Yeah. I mean, I love where we live. I love Seattle as a city so far of what I've experienced, and I've barely scratched the surface. You know how it is.
Yeah.
If you're in pro sports, whether you're an athlete or a coach, doesn't matter. You're pretty busy.
Yeah. It is funny because people think when you travel, like you have some like, oh, you get to go to these cities, and you don't get to go to these cities. No. You basically show up, you get on a plane, you go to the hotel, you go to the practice, and you get back on.
You're like, all hotels look the same. What city are we in?
Yeah, the food's all about the same. It's always a Marriott. Yeah. You're like, oh boy, everything's a turkey dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
So what about like the change, like the athletes, and like more importantly, like your approach to working with them?
Yeah, so prior to Chicago, I worked at Auburn University for almost 12 years. So in the collegiate side, worked a lot of different sports, so men's and women's, both sides, football, basketball, kind of the whole gamut. And then going to the pro side, a difference there, right? Like in when you work within the pro women's side in the U.S., you're working with some of the best footballers in the world. Mm-hmm. Some of the best footballers in the men's side are also in the U.S., but there's also a lot over in Europe and other places.
Explain that one to me. Like, why is it that like the best male soccer players come from like Brazil and these other countries, but yet like the top female are usually from America? Is it because like if you're a really great athlete and as a, you know, as a woman here in America, you play soccer, whereas dudes that are really good athletes here in America don't necessarily play soccer?
I think that, I mean, part of it, one, you're talking about the culture of Brazil and kind of what they did technically of having so much futsal and not necessarily just soccer. So the technical ability of some of those players, and then also how they built.
Did I tell you my Brazil story?
No, let's go.
So I told you this, didn't I?
It's a very good one.
So Tony Gonzalez, like the funny joke is the best trick the NFL ever played was convincing the world that Tony Gonzalez was Mexican. He's not.
Yeah.
His family's from the Azores, and when they came through Ellis Island, they gave him the Gonzalez when it was like Gonkel. So the NFL used to capitalize on that. So Tony had this big thing with like a following in like Latin America NFL. So we got to go to Brazil for a month. And we were actually in Rio, and we were walking down, like it was during Carnival. We were walking down the street, like me and like seven like big black dudes who played in the NFL with us.
A scene in Brazil.
Have no business being where we were. Like,
yeah.
Like the most dangerous place.
Yeah.
We were fine. And we walked down and there was like an alleyway, and there must have been about 60 kids in this alleyway. Now, mind you, it was probably as wide as this table.
Yeah.
Playing futsal.
Yep.
Like this incredible game with trash cans, and like they were bouncing it off the wall, jumping off the wall. We stopped and we're like, we thought it was like a fight. And like these kids were kicking this like homemade ball that looked like a ball they'd wrap in duct tape.
Yeah.
And they were, and there was multiple balls. Yep. There was like four balls. There was like multiple goals. And like, I don't know what they played. And then later on, we were like, what was that game? And somebody was like, oh, it's futsal. It's or fusel.
Yeah.
And it's a soccer game these kids play. And then they related why the best soccer players in the world, of course, come from Brazil because of this game.
And, you know, one, that's a great story. I would love to go to Rio also with those same people that you went with.
Dude, when I tell you dangerous, like we had we somehow convinced these people to take us up to where the Corcovado de Cristo is, like, you know, the big Jesus statue. And it's right in the middle of like the gnarliest favela.
Yeah.
Like you're driving through and you're like, there's dudes with AK-47s, like shanties, the whole deal. And I'm like, we're probably going to be fine. Like there are way easier people to rob than us.
Yeah.
So like that was like.
When you said Brazil story, I thought you were going to tell the coconut dodgeball one.
Oh, that was a great time. That was another great story. So we started in Bahia in the north, and then we traveled like down and went to Rio and then went to Florianopolis. And so I got up early one morning, like there was all this like, you know, parades, and I just got up and I was like, man, there was like every quarter mile in Brazil, there's like a pull-up structure. And like everybody, like that's why I think gyms would fail there, because it was like pull-ups, sit-ups, the whole deal.
Yeah.
So I go down there and do some pull-ups. I'm like, this is great. I like see some dude on the street like selling coconuts. So I get these like big coconuts. I'm like, oh, this is great. I'm in Brazil. I got to swim. It's early. I'm like seeing all these people. And I turn around and there are these kids following me. There's like 5 or 10 of these kids, and they're probably like 8, 9, 10 years old. And I like kind of see them, and I kind of turn around, look over my shoulder, and I just turned around and they pulled out steak knives like they were going to mug me. And the kid like said something basically like, you know, like, F you, give me your money. And so I took the coconut and basically smashed him in the face with it and then chased the kids. And then later on, I like told the story. I'm like, ah, oh, these kids were playing around. And they were like, you know, those kids legitimately stab people and rob them. I'm like, well, they didn't rob anybody today, but that kid caught a coconut in the face.
How a coconut saved your life.
Dude, when I say I threw this thing, I hit that kid square in the face, and those kids dropped their knives and took off running, and I chased them. And like the story, my buddy, like we were telling our guide, and he was like, you shouldn't do that. Those kids hurt people. I'm like, ah, just kids playing around. They just had like little steak knives. They'll be fine.
Yeah.
That was a funny story too. Poor kid. And now I think about it, I'm like, holy shit, that was terrible. Good thing there's no social media around to catch me on that one.
Or you could have died.
There's also that side. He's worried about like how that looks optics wise. Yeah, and I'm like, you also could have died.
Yeah, no, I have evaded death so many times. At this point, like I'm like a cat. Like I'm on my last. I'm like, believe me, this kid's not going to kill me. If the NFL couldn't kill me,
What's your favorite death evasion story?
Oh man,
that's a good one.
My favorite death evasion story. I was in Daytona Beach for Daytona Bike Week, and a buddy of mine, while I was an active NFL player, a buddy of mine had this badass twin turbo Hayabusa with an air shifter, and I got on the bike and clicked it into first gear, hit the air shifter, and the bike took off, and I kind of laid down on the tank and I watched the speedo hit 200.
Yep.
And I was in fifth gear.
Yeah.
And then I let off and slowed it down and brought it back around. Had no helmet, so I did 200 miles an hour on a Hayabusa laying on the tank with no helmet.
Were you thinking before you got on that bike, or was it just like, just this is cool and I'm going to go for it?
I just hit the throttle and started hitting the air shifter, and the next thing I know, the thing was like a two. That just literally took off like a shot. I could hear the turbos whine, and I was like, oh, shit, look how fast this thing is. Yeah, it was fast.
Glad there were no rocks.
Yeah, I'm glad the road was nice and smooth.
Yeah.
But yeah, when people are like, oh, you've been 200 miles, I'm like, on a motorcycle without a helmet. So yeah, that's stupidity. So unfortunately, I've been pretty good at evading this stuff.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. Back to what you were saying too about like soccer culturally, there's different forms of play, right? Like there's German style of play. Like there's some key figures within soccer that have developed different styles of play. And you see other people like use those, whether it's formations or different systems and styles, like that pervades all cultures within soccer. There's nothing new. Everything old is just repeated with new words, right? But different coaches and organizations will say like, this is the style we're going to play, or also we're going to get players and then fit the style to the player. So same in football. Are you going towards your athlete, or is your athlete fitting your system?
So do you have a system and you draft your system, or are you basically building a system around the people you got?
Exactly. And some of that obviously is longevity too. You know, in the NFL, it's win now and win forever. There's a little bit of like development and building and those kind of things that happen within football and, soccer a little bit more, I would say, versus if you don't win, you're done pretty much. There's also the business model is completely different. The way you make a business out of soccer is the buying, selling, and trading of players.
Power Athlete Nation, want to take 1 minute to remind you why Power Athlete is performance for the people. We love the garage gymmer. We love the athlete that is taking their performance into their own hands. We offer 8 different strength and conditioning programs reverse engineered from common goals like getting jacked, becoming more athletic, or introducing the barbell for the first time. To learn which program is best for you, head to powerathletehq.com/training. If you're an enthusiast, a parent, or professional coach, we also offer education. At academy.powerathletehq.com, learn the method to the madness, the Power Athlete methodology, and a hell of a lot more. Next up, shop.powerathletehq.com. Hoodies, tees, sweats, shorts, you name it, we got it, including posters. You put this up in your garage gym, you're staring at it underneath the bar, I guarantee that you're going to add 10% to your next rep max. And finally, you can check us out on YouTube. We're dropping movement demonstrations, going through our setup and execution of the finer movements found on all of our Power Athlete training programs, and cutting clips of this podcast that you're listening to right now. So if you want to share in this experience with your lifting buddies, go ahead, seek out Power Athlete on YouTube. And now, back to the premier podcast in strength and conditioning.
Really?
So if you have an academy and you develop age groups all the way up, yes, you're doing that to also then fill your first team roster, second team roster, and have ticket sales and fans and all those things and marketing and television just like the NFL. But there's a whole other side of that market where you're developing players so that they're in a good position to be assets elsewhere.
So then they basically have contracts and they sell the contracts. And so there's kind of a like development league.
Yeah. And even so, let's say you have a player that's pretty good and I didn't even know this thing existed, but you can sell technically like I think different portions of players. So let's say you sell them and you retain royalty rights to a percentage of them. They get sold again. So now you're making money off of them when they've been outside of your organization now twice.
Wow. How do the players feel about this?
Yeah.
I mean, I think if the players are developing and then playing at high levels, like players are athletes, they want to compete, they want to win, and they want to get paid. So if those things are all checking the box, it's like that's part of it.
There was some weird coup in soccer that they tried to start a different league. Did that go against this plan?
Which league? Like, I feel like this happens all the time in soccer. It's like, we're going to have our own league. And then it's like, oh, no, it didn't happen.
Well, I mean, the present league, what's this?
MLS.
So this is MLS.
Yeah.
So MLS has been, I mean, what, like 20 years, 30 years?
Yeah.
I mean, they've been around a long time. So they've established teams, they've established rosters.
Yep.
And would you say that the majority of like the, you know, because I mean, sadly, the only time I watch women's soccer is when during the Olympics.
And World Cup, hopefully.
And World Cup. But like, you know, it's not like I'm like on a Thursday afternoon. I'm like, oh, hey, women's soccer's on. Let's watch. Even though I scroll around, look for it because I have daughters. So I'm trying to expose them to sports.
Yeah.
Like women's basketball. Like my daughter made it. She's like, this is awful. Let's watch the men's stuff. It's so much faster. And I was like, bite your tongue. but that type of, you know, but like women's soccer is exciting because, I mean, even more so because I think they're more technical than the men.
I think it's two different games. It's hard to compare. It's kind of like in women's basketball, for the most part, is played below the rim. Men's basketball is played above the rim. I think soccer is almost similar to that. There's very few women that are hitting an 80-yard diagonal ball, you know, so the game is just played a little bit differently. I think both of them are beautiful in their own way. I love the physicality of both sides of it. Some people would say that the women's game, there's less flopping in the fouls.
Yeah.
So go ahead. I know you have
I think it's more physical because the men just look like prima donnas.
Like, men are better actors. Is it that the men are better actors?
I think it's culturally like too. That's the way the game came up. Was you had to draw fouls. You had to draw opportunities because really you're drawing a opportunity to score in a game that doesn't allow for many opportunities to score. Kind of makes sense. But now, like, you know, obviously if you flop, you can be issued a yellow card. So they're trying to kind of reinforce the rules and regulations around that. And I think culturally just different styles of play. Like the reason, back to your point of the U.S. women World Cup champions, like Olympic champions, World Cup champions, they've done this multiple times. Shout out to Canada for winning their own too. Sure. Right. So when we say like, okay, there was a league in the NWSL that a lot of these players were playing in was also because it was helping build out what the national team was trying to do. And that was, you know, under the guidance of Jill Ellis when she was the head coach. And like, so I think what you're seeing now is there's also opportunity for the EPL has made the Premier League has made a big push to give big contracts to some of these players to bring them over to grow their league. And you've seen more partnerships like Man City's women's team. Like most of these teams have a women's team now, which is amazing. And
that's pretty recent.
Yeah.
Like 10 years ago, that didn't exist.
Some of them did not. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I had a player that was Australian and very good and now is playing in Europe. Like I'm happy for her because getting paid her due, right? And the NWSL is growing too, like addition of two teams this year, and you have European coaches coming over here to coach now, you know, and things like that. So I think that league is in a good place and only going to continue to grow. The MLS definitely has been around longer, and new expansion teams here in Texas and Austin, right? And great stadiums. I'd love to see a women's team in Texas too. That'd be awesome. Then you can take your daughters there.
Anytime I can get them to see sports where like, you know, girls get to go out and compete and aren't just, you know, like, I don't know, like just kind of like rough and ready.
Yeah.
You know,
the
like
intensity.
Yeah, that's exactly what like that's what I want them to see.
Yeah.
Like this isn't something universal to like men or women.
Yeah.
This is athletes playing at the highest level. And like doing it well.
Yeah.
Like, incredible execution and, like, you know, great athletes moving through space and doing exciting things. I mean, that was, you know, I mean, I think that's what we hope for in terms of role models.
Absolutely. And one thing I appreciate about soccer is that there's so many different types of athletes. It's almost like track and field, right? You have to have your long distance runners in track and field to do well and win team championships. You also have to have your midfielders that can maintain possession and play pretty soccer and run all day. But yeah, you need that forward that can sprint and beat everybody in behind. So it creates opportunity for different types of athletes to also succeed. So if you are super technical and that's your strong skill set, be that player. Mm-hmm. So and that bleeds into training too.
So how does, like, the like you were talking about, like a feeder system, like a farm team, like, you know, they bring people on and develop, like, where does that, like, age? I mean, are most of the girls playing in college and then, like, you know, feeding into this, or is it even like coming out of high school and not even going to college and just getting right into, like, you know, kind of like in Europe? Like, I was amazed the amount of guys that, you know, for soccer and also rugby, like, don't go to college.
Yeah.
They, you know, at 10, 12 years old, they get put into these programs and they get into these feeders. And I remember getting reached out to by, like, I want to say it was like a soccer team in Spain, and like their first team was like 10 and 12 year old kids. And then they had another that was 14 to 16, and they take these kids all the way. And they were, like, you know, introducing them to barbells at like 18 years old, but not at this. And I was like, wait a minute, like, we don't do that in America. Like, you know, we play in high school and we go on to college.
Yep.
And so I didn't know how that works for women.
It's very different for men and women. Even over here, we have that, like, where there's age development teams, starts U13, U14, and then U16, and then U17. And then you have, like, second team, then you have first team. So there's all of that. And you have players that play up and down. So players that are on the second team get a call up for a game. And then you also have things like homegrown players. When a homegrown player goes through a developmental system, and you have different right retentions to them versus when you just bring in a new player. So all of that comes in play. For women, the structure in the U.S. is still more of, hey, you play in a club setting. High school, I can't speak to the relevance or not. Like, I don't know the world of high school soccer. I know the world of college and pro, so I can speak to that. Most of them play in club, and then they go into college, most of them. There are a couple players that now are getting signed as pros without going to college. And that is, I think, going to become more of a norm, and you'll see more developmental systems, like, on the men's side. It's not there yet. Like, college is still the standard of, like, hey, you play college, and then you still have a lot of, well, what's the financial gain of me going in to try and play pro versus going and starting my degree job, right?
Sure.
And so I think that there's still, like, that lack of opportunity for everyone. And when you start to see the league continue to grow, add more teams, hopefully eventually add second teams, then I think we're at a similar conversation. Right now, I'd say the big question mark is, you're either elite when you're, you know, U20 age, or and you're finishing out college and going into a career, or you're going into your professional setting.
Gotcha.
Or success in the career, like, as if it's baseball, if it's basketball, like, your progression and development as a professional is gradual. But it seems like tennis and soccer, it's like a flash in the pan. The younger you are, the higher you rise. Is there something to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some interesting academy systems over the world and how they do that. And they even talk about socialization. When you have these kids that their school is at the training grounds and all of this, and that development is way different than having a normal school and learning what it's like to socialize and have awkward kid time, right? Like, where did that go? So I think that they speak to that as part of the process and saying, how do we teach them to socialize? Especially now, can you imagine with technology?
Yes. one of my most favorite things is, I have twin girls that are 10,
mm-hmm.
and then my little boy's 5. I love picking my kids up from school, and I love driving them to school. But I love, like, talking to them, just like, so how was school today? Or, like, asking them about, like, what about the boys group, or, like, the cliques, and more importantly, like, their impressions of other kids and different things. Tears. Like, I laugh, like, constantly. Like my daughter told me that everybody breaks down into three groups. There's wild kids, there's semi-wild kids, and then there's boring kids. And, like, I was like, well, what's a wild kid? Well, they scream a lot. What about those? Well, they kind of scream. What about the boring kids? No, they don't ever scream. So, like, I'm like, so wait a minute, who's screaming? And it's like, well, they yell a lot. I'm like, when? In class? She's like, no, on the playground. I'm like, what are you yelling at? She's like, I don't know. People just yell a lot. And, like, just these, like, ridiculous things that they put together, or the and then they've also added they play games on their phone, so like I think it's called Roblox.
Okay.
And so then what they'll do is they end up on these group chats where like they're on speakerphone playing these games, and I can hear them yelling at each other, and I'm like, what are you yelling about? And it reminds me of like guys in Call of Duty like screaming at each other. And she'll be in and like all these names like whatever noob, and like this other, we're like, that's I'm like, listen to this, I'm like, you guys are hilarious. But just hearing like the interactions. And I think what sucks is that when they had Zoom school, they didn't have any of these interactions. They would have like, hey, we're going to like Zoom with this kid, or like they would have like almost like play dates.
Like a Zoom hangout.
It was fucking awful. Yeah. Like I was mortified for them. But we're lucky. We live next door to a horse riding school. So my one daughter rides. And so there's all these kids over there. So I'm like, just go over there and like hang outside with the horses. Like go do, like there's always kids over there.
My brother just bought a bunch of land and built a house on it in North Carolina where we're from, and literally got horses because his daughter loves horses. So when you have playground in your backyard, you don't have to go far, you know? So I'm very happy for them.
And the hilarious part is, so my daughter, they jump horses.
Oh, wow.
And so there's a whole drama of these girls and their horses, and like that is, it's like a TV show. So I love it. Like I ask them questions all the time. I'm like, well, why, you know, and I'm inquisitive, and like periodically I'll just turn on my phone and video it and be like, this is great. And I'll send it to my wife, and she's like, 20 years, we're going to roast them with all this shit. I can't wait. But yeah, my, today was a big day. So my daughter, they're 10, and my one daughter is actually the same height as my wife. So I'll show you a picture.
How's your wife feel about that?
She said that the reason she married me was that she was she hated being short. So,
oh no.
So there's my daughter at 10, and she's got her. Yeah. So like she was like it's
much
good.
Earlier than
she's
expected.
Like, that's why I married you at 6'6", so that we wouldn't have short kids. Because my wife's like, I never liked being short. So it was funny.
She figured that out.
It was a big day today. She's like, is she taller than me? Yes. Yeah.
And the other twin, how tall is she?
Probably 3 inches shorter.
My partner's a twin with a brother. Uh-huh. And so just like fascinating stories. I see pictures of them growing up and I have no idea who's who. And I'm like, they both had red hair, and it's just, it's fascinating. I'm like, this is bad.
Wow. Yeah. So my one daughter is tall and brunette with brown eyes, and my other daughter's blonde with green eyes, and she's shorter.
Wow.
And so like the point where they'll go to school, and like Jamie, who's my, or the taller one, one of the girls was like, ah, that Killy girl, she's a, you know, basically she's a bitch, and she's made, like, was talking trash, and she's like, you know, it's my sister. And the girl thought she was lying to her because they're in separate classes. She's like, no, legitimately, that's my sister. And they're like, no way. She's like, really? She's like, yeah, that's my twin sister.
And then she pulls out her steak knife.
Yeah. And then but Jamie has a rare ability. She can talk shit. Like to the point where, like,
that it's been trained.
Well, I've been
honed.
I've been prepping her for a long time to talk trash.
Okay.
And she's pretty good at it. So she can like verbally assault people pretty well.
Is that a part of your action board you were talking about?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So part of her thing is like somebody like screaming with words coming out. Yeah. No, she's because I always think that you need to be able to physically defend yourself, but you need to be able to verbally defend yourself.
True.
And I think like that's like a big thing for me is like I'm not always going to be around. So then they need to, one, be able to take care of each other, and they need to be able to defend themselves both, you know, like, and that, like that, that's something I never wanted to raise women that weren't capable.
Yeah.
That's a thing that always drove me crazy, where like, you know, dads kind of raise their daughters almost like little princesses.
Yeah.
And I wanted to raise my daughters just like boys. And like, you know, because I always feel like, you know, like it's just such a weird deal. Like, oh, you know, like I'm going to raise my boys to go out and conquer the world, but I'm going to treat my daughters like little princesses. Like it drove me crazy with fathers. They'd be like, you know, like, oh, look how pretty you are. And not that they aren't pretty, but I've never.
Yeah.
Put that at the forefront. I'm like, you know, are you capable? Are you intelligent? Can you know, like that? Like that was, it was more important for me to raise capable women than pretty little girls that just have bows in their hair.
Well, that'll give them the confidence to be whatever type of woman they want to be. So if they want to be prissy later, and they can be that, they can do whatever.
But the other one too is I never wanted to raise girls that felt like they had to wait for somebody to come save them. Like the idea that like you're going to be the damsel in distress and some guy's going to ride up on a horse and protect, you know, save you. I'm like, like, no, that's not who we're, that's not what we're doing here. No, you need to learn to change tires. Yeah. Like, you got to learn to drive a manual transmission. Yeah. Like,
I had that list growing up too. I learned to drive a manual on a tractor. That was interesting. There's a lot of mailboxes that came down that day.
Well, we've been working on it. The problem is I got a double disc clutch on my truck. So it's a little heavy. So my daughter's
double clutching like you ought.
Yeah. So the, I have taught them to shoot. That's mm-hmm. another big one. So like, we have a ton of pigs,
yep.
like, so we're constantly shooting pigs. So I told my daughters, like, this year, I'm like, you guys have got to go out and shoot pigs too.
Yep.
So we were out there like trying to like figure out and find like, so I put together some lighter guns for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big one too. They're like, these are too heavy. I'm like, let's get lighter ones.
Yeah.
So like, but that's what I want for them. I want them to feel like capable. And, I was like, you know, at some point you're going to have to save some dude
yep.
or, you know, whoever, but like, that's what I want for them, like yeah. capable women. I just don't like how society kind of creates this, like, this damsel in distress. I'm like, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, all the Disney movies, like, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I was raised, I guess I was my own person from the day I came out. Like, it just, I had a grandmother that was like an anesthetician. I could have gotten facials. I thought that was normal. Like, oh, you get facials, you're 10 years old. Like, that's an option upstairs in everybody's house. But I was like, yeah, no, I don't want that. Like, I just want to play outside and I want to get dirty. I want to go work on the farm. I wanted to do that kind of stuff. And the biggest fights I ever had with my mom growing up were around clothes, right? Like, oh, you need to get dressed up for this. I'm like, absolutely not. Like, and so I think it's just fascinating.
Fight on that one too.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, it's they, like, why?
My kids dress like hobos.
Yeah. It's so much better.
So I tell them, I'm like, I tell them all the time, I'm like, hey, so I accuse my one daughter of being colorblind. I'm like, nobody would have put that two those outfits together. And then she we'll get in the car and she'll forget her socks or a sock or a shoe, and like it's hilarious. I'm like, I would have never left school with, or would have never left the house without shoes. There's a good chance my daughters are leaving without shoes.
Yeah.
And then I'm like,
well, but be a college athlete, you can wear sweatpants, flip flops, whatever the hell you want to class.
Or a pro, you can even be even better. But like I think a lot of times, and I think you've seen this with athletes too, where because people are gifted athletes early, they're allowed to be incomplete people. And
yeah.
I think we saw this in football all the time. I mean, we still see it. We see guys in the NFL who are just incomplete people because they were so gifted athletically that people were just willing to do shit for them
yeah.
or were able to make excuses for them.
Or didn't want to get in the way too, right? Like, I feel like that's part of it is almost passivism. Like, I don't want to do anything that could change your opportunities so that you just focus on this.
Yeah, but like,
I don't think sometimes it's that deceitful of like, yeah. oh, I'm just going to make excuses so you can do whatever. I think sometimes it is good intention, but they don't have education to support it.
But to me, that's just enabling. Like,
true.
Like, and I saw this entire my NFL career. I saw it in college where dudes were incomplete. Like they somebody did not teach them the basic skills they need to be successful in life because yeah. they were such gifted athletes.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a cop out.
I agree with parts of that, like accountability, trust, loyalty, like those things we talk about that should be non-negotiables. I feel like for people, the excuses and different things like that. Absolutely. But those are the people that, they can become pros, right? But eventually something's going to catch up. How long can you be a pro?
Yeah.
And well, some of that washes in there.
I mean, what's amazing in female and women's soccer, the longevity these girls have in their careers is crazy.
Yeah, look at Carly Lloyd.
I mean, these girls are like in their late 30s and 40s and they're still playing at a high level.
You know, and age stigma, I think, is something that should be talked about in sport, especially like, hey, you're this age and doing this. And I'm like, maybe we've talked about the increase in lifespan. We've never talked about an increase in athletic lifespan.
Well, I mean, it's like, look at Tom Brady.
Exactly.
I mean, he's the best to ever do the job, and all they ever do is bring up his age.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, how much more like age shaming do they do for this poor guy?
Yeah.
But like, there's such a weird deal. Like in the NFL, like their perception of you almost goes from like rose-colored glasses to like black tint when you turn 30.
Yeah.
Like I remember I was 29 and like them talking to me one way, and then 30, like all of a sudden I turned 30 and I was like, did the room just get chilly?
Eligible
like,
contracts, only 1 year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it was incredible. Yeah. Like the, you know, the way people talked to me when I was at 32 was different than I was 28. I'm like, I'm really the same person. Like, yeah. What's going on here?
And how with science and all these other things we can do with assessment, there's so many great things we can do to study the body to not just identify both sides biological age. It's like, yeah, why are we just sticking with that one?
Football coaches and more importantly, scouts and the people that make those decisions aren't the sharpest knives in the drawer.
And so, they've been doing it for a long time.
So like probably, I mean, but So this is wild to me. I was looking at some NFL film stuff.
Yeah.
And like when dudes were like legitimately in their 30s, when you see some of the older NFLs, those guys might have been 130. Like a 30-year-old NFL player, you're like, you see Terry Bradshaw or like who was it, Kenny Stabler, these guys, like take their, like they were like 32. They took off the helmet, like full head of gray hair. And you're like, holy shit, dude, those dudes look old. Yeah. Then you look at Tom Brady. I mean, I don't know if he's had any work done. I kind of think he has. But he still looks, he looks healthy and young, and he moves pretty well. I mean, he's, you know, I mean, he's legitimately had three or four NFL or Hall of Fame careers.
Yeah.
So like, why is it that age is such an issue for him?
Yeah.
Just because they have nothing else to talk about.
Maybe.
But like, I know when like, when like watching the Olympics, like they always bring that up. Like, you know, they want to talk about the young girls and like, you know, they're the future, and then the old guard.
Like gymnasts especially, right?
Yeah.
And even tennis. Like I remember Roger Federer, like as soon as he got into a certain age, and then Rafa Nadal, they're like, this is going to be their last time. And then it's like 7 years later, this is going to be their last time.
Yeah. We'll look at Simone Biles.
Yeah.
Like those girls peak at what, like 14 years old. And then they're like, you know, she's in her 20s and is better than all these other girls. And they're like, we can't believe it. She's defied age. And I'm like, she's like 22 years old.
Serena Williams.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the other thing they don't talk about too, is one thing you'll never have to deal with as an NFL player is have a baby while you're also a pro. I've had this happen 3 times, and expected, unexpected, whatever, doesn't matter. But it's like, that's a whole journey and process. And that's something that's like a stigma as well. But I've had players come back, and I mean, the way they play afterwards, it's, some of them are better. Why? I mean, any athlete that goes through an injury, what do they get a ton of that pro careers don't afford? Training,
rest.
Training and rest. Yeah. Oh, you gotta let your body actually heal after having a baby, you know? So, I think that's an interesting thing, like the ageism, and then also just like having children. Like, why is that not something we accept more?
Man, I don't know. Like there's so many stigmas attached to female sports, but also to male sports.
Yeah.
I think that the people that are making the decisions have this optics that I still hear, you know, announcers and different people say shit where I'm like, I can't believe the person just said that.
I understand. I muted a lot
like,
of times.
Like, I'm sure, and you're like, I can't believe that shit. Just like, yeah. You've seen the Pitch Perfect movies?
Of course.
Okay. Like, you know, the male announcer dude who he just says like a ton of like
inappropriate things
shit.
All the time.
All the time. It's like, you know, and like it's to the point, like I have, my daughters love those movies.
Yeah.
So of course I've watched them all, and I think they're hysterical.
You actually watch them before them?
I have daughters and I've watched them.
There you go.
But the dude where it's like, wow, that was really sexist. And he'll be like, yeah, you know, like that's where I hear like announcers, especially on the female sports, say some shit. I'm like, God damn, I can't believe they just said that.
Yeah.
And I just think maybe it's a cultural thing. I mean, maybe it's just like, I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of the way the media is covering sports these days.
Well, and sometimes
anyway, too,
right? Like announcers that work a men's sport, they'll cover a women's sport, but it doesn't go vice versa. Like I think Doris Burke just covered an NBA game, and that was like the first ever on live TV or whatever. And I'm like, there, it's easy to be given a women's sport. It's hard to earn a men's sport.
Well, the NFL realized that their greatest, the place they were failing the most was in converting women over into football fans.
Mm-hmm.
So so all like the women's sideline announcers and the, and you know, that whole thing was not like these women have availed themselves.
Yeah.
That was 100% an optics change to try to pull more women in, because they came in with this huge demographic. So I was sitting in a meeting where they were like, they circled. They're like, this huge demographic, like I think they said women purchase like 80% of everything.
Yeah.
Like even like men's clothes.
Consumerism.
Like,
yes.
Yeah.
So where do you get your clothes? Your wife gets them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The optics for that was like pretty apparent in the NFL, and they even said like, we're changing this whole thing. Like I was sitting in a meeting for the NFLPA, and they're like, Susan P. Komen Foundation, which are good charities, but like they didn't do it for benevolent reasons,
right?
They did it because they were trying to attract more female
opportunity,
like more female fans to purchase more shit.
Yep.
And like, you know, it's the reason they have, you know, Michelle Tafoya and all this other stuff, not because they're incredibly gifted or they have something to say. It's because they found demographic groups that women identify with other women. If it's a whole bunch of dudes, they're not going to identify with it.
Yeah. And I mean, you see that in coaching too, right? Like it's not just on the sidelines, or it's how many females were athletic trainers when you were in the NFL?
Man, maybe we had more in college. Yeah. So at Berkeley, we had probably.
At Berkeley.
Yeah, at Berkeley. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's. Yeah. That's why I prefaced it.
Small conservative school in Northern California?
Yeah. I always refer to Berkeley as a small conservative school in Northern California. You might have heard of it, you know? In the NFL, I can't think. I mean, we didn't have a female strength coach. We didn't have a woman. I mean, we obviously had some lady docs, but we didn't have any women trainers.
So I asked a couple of my guys when I arrived, I was like, have you ever had a female coach? He's like, most of the answers I got were, I've had a PT or like an athletic trainer. I'm like, that's great. And you see that, like that growth in the dietitian space and the sports med space, but it's still like lingering. There's a few, but it's like, man, what's the hesitancy there? And something I said when I was talking to different ownership groups and different conversations over my career was, you know, it's interesting that a lot of players, a good majority of men's players, are raised by who? A single mom. And their most important relationships culturally, if they're Latin, is their family and their mothers and their grandmothers. And yet, when we bring a female into the space, they're treated completely different. I'm treated with more respect for being a female, not because I'm a woman in the space, but because when they see me, I am a female. Does that make sense? And it's like, wow. And now the coaching and the relationship is completely different. So to something I heard you say earlier, it's, you know, how do you make someone mentally tough? To me, that's through consistency. Like, it's not through verbiage. It's not through tone. It's not through those things. It's how do you draw consistent effort out of someone and then repeat that process in perpetuity? And I think when you bring in different people that are raised different ways and from different socioeconomic statuses, it's really easy to start drawing connection when you look like someone that's already been important to them.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
When I went from Philadelphia to Kansas City, I moved back to California, and I ended up training at Athletes Performance.
Oh yeah.
And Abby Wambach was one of our training partners.
Yeah.
So
she's all right.
Yeah, she's all right. So it was really the first, like, because you know, I mean, like, I didn't grow up with sisters,
yep.
You know, so pretty much like my mom was the only girl we knew growing up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't have any female cousins, so yeah. Like it was all boys. And then I went to college and obviously played football and all. Like I had never worked in a situation or even had a female training partner until I went to Athletes Performance and Abby trained with us. And I don't give this title easily, fucking savage, like a completely different type of athlete to the point where like she would like sense weakness on us and fucking go harder.
Yep.
And like she was an incredible training partner, and to the point where like it wasn't like any point where you're like, you're gonna let this girl beat you. I'm like, you know, it was interesting removal where like it wasn't necessarily sex related in terms of like she was like ran like, and she trained with us.
Yep.
Like she did all of our football sprints. She did all of our agilities, did everything. I mean, trained in all of our groups. Like if we were, I mean, like I remember we had, Verstegen had these three Versa climbers that were all kind of bolted together. And we used to have to do like, it was 100 step races.
Yep.
And like, we would go and tell people just quit. And dude, that girl had no quit in her.
Yep.
To the point where I was like, holy shit, dude, this girl's going to fucking kill me. I got to try to go. And, she was, I was always so impressed with her as an athlete, and I've always told people, I'm like, that's still to this day one of the hardest working people, a person I've ever been around.
Yeah,
you know, and she's okay.
Yeah, she's Dees. You know, I think,
Diesel. Yeah,
yeah, Diesel. Yeah.
No, she's good.
When you work with athletes that have high motors, I think that gender is a thing, male, female, but I think there's also elite athlete. Like we can just remove kind of that whole thing from the conversation. And it's like when you see elite athletes enter the room, there's a different sense to everything and how they train, how they prepare. And I'm talking like the 1% of the 1%. And it's fascinating to work with those people, but it's also fascinating to just hear more about their lives and how they approach everything. It's with that same kind of competitive edge. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you know, people are universe, like it's not as if like competition is somehow like split.
Yeah.
Like I mean, like you know, the level of competition is still high, and like people don't like to lose.
Yep.
Like that's not a male or female, that's not like a, you know, if you don't like to lose, you don't like to lose. I don't give a shit who it is.
Yep.
And that was always my deal. Like I didn't care if we were playing checkers or chess or football, whatever it is, I just don't like to lose.
And risk aversion, right? That's not gender specific either. Like no, if you're not willing to risk, then that's who you are. And yeah. I think you are pretty risky, 206.
No, I have, I mean, I've like legitimately been like, I can't believe my mom always said, she's like, I'm just amazed you're here. And I'm like, I think I just cheated death too many times. But I mean, that's probably pretty accurate for most athletes because to be able to do that job, you have to be, like you said, risk averse. And there's a certain personality that's like, no, I'm going to strap on this helmet. I'm going to run 100 miles an hour into these people over and over again.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I think the one thing that I think we're seeing now is that we're training athletes like athletes and not necessarily dividing them and kind of putting them based upon, you know, sex and gender and all these other things.
Yeah. And also, I think we're training athletes as people and like humans. It's not just, oh, you play this sport and that's what you do. Yeah, that's a huge driving factor. But there's so many other factors that go into how you are coming into the gym that day and what's actually the priority, right? And understanding all those things changes training. Like, I'm not saying that you're not going to train, but we can definitely pivot on what we were going to be doing based on some of these other things that may be happening.
Have you seen, you know, like the physiology? Is there a different physiology for training? You know, like we've experienced it where, like, you know, we found that like women could handle a higher percentage of their 1RM for more reps. Mm-hmm. Like that, yeah. like we found some really interesting stuff where we were doing like Hatfield's muscle fiber test where we were asking people to squat a 1RM and then taking off 20% and asking them to do max reps. And if they go 5 to 7 and, you know, and this whole deal. And we had a girl who was a pretty high level triple jumper at San Luis Obispo.
Mm-hmm.
She squatted like, I think a legit like 315 and a body weight of like 135. So she was strong, head trained, big background. We strip off 80%. She did like 30 reps.
Yeah. I think there is something to that, especially when you talk about power athletes. So if you're talking a jumper or a thrower, like, yeah, there's something different there. As a former thrower, it's funny. We were sitting around earlier talking stories about Jude Logan, who passed away recently.
Yeah,
and the number of coaches he's influenced, because I don't know if you know this fun fact, but if you were a thrower and you're also a coach, we probably all know each other. Like, there's...
Oh, no, no. So the joke that we have is that all the throwers we know as parents were all friends.
Yeah.
And they didn't let them sign the permission slip.
Correct.
So that's always the joke. It's like, you guys could all play, oh, your mom didn't sign the permission slip. And they're all friends.
We can't be friends until now. Yeah. We just found each other. Yeah. And it's fascinating because we were talking about some of that training volume. And one thing I remember from throwing, and I've met a lot of really cool, much better than me throwers along the way, is how much we can handle high level percentages and have our best competitions. So the intensity, but also the volume side of it. We could do volume and I feel great going into a comp. Whereas I think there is a big difference in it may be more muscle fiber typing and even neural sympathetic, parasympathetic drive of an athlete. And we just didn't know what to call it back then. We're like, oh yeah, you're just powerful, you know, or you're just strong. Like that's probably the way we classified things back then. But now it'd be much more interesting to dive into like some of the HRV and things like that around training.
What was Adam?
Nelson?
Yeah. I know you know what I'm talking about, Adam Nelson, but you remember he did, it was like 585 for like a set of like 25 or he did.
Yeah. Fantastic story.
God,
Two more.
Yeah.
Yeah. For our listeners on YouTube, Adam, just search Adam Nelson, power athlete. He breaks it down. Amazing storyteller, amazing athlete, gold medalist.
Yeah. But yeah, he squats like something crazy, like 600 pounds for like, you know, 20 plus reps and like, you know, failed it or like at 18, they're like two more, just keep stacking them on. And he told me the story and I told him like, hey man, like the one thing I'm bummed at is there was no social media because if I had seen you do that, I would have flown out and come and trained with you. Like same with Derek Woodsky.
Yeah.
If I had known that those guys were out there doing that because we were training in our own personal groups and we were in our bubble, thought we were killing it. And if I had known that somebody else out there that I thought was training harder than us, I would have either flown them out or we would have gone and seen them.
1,000%.
And, that's one thing I always tell them. Like, I'm so bummed that one, we weren't friends and two, there wasn't social media. Cause if I'd known you motherfuckers were out there, I would have shown up and knocked on your door.
And the other side of it is I don't, you know, given your throwing distances of whatever they were back in the day, you were never a bad thrower. You were just throwing in the wrong decade.
I like that one.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Like 20 years ago, you would have got the gold medal. Today, not so
correct.
Much.
Correct. Like Krauser and those guys that are just PR and PR and PR. And every time they throw, it's over a certain distance. You're just like, yeah, I was in the wrong decade. And like Michelle Carter, Laura Garrity, like those throws. I'm like, my first college meet was against the Olympian. Like here we are. Like that's the timeline, you know?
And I know Derek was told me a ton of Jeff Logan stories. And I just seemed like a pretty legendary dude. And
so I didn't know him when I was a thrower. We actually got to know each other because I had the same type of leukemia as him. So I got diagnosed in 2015. He was diagnosed a couple of years later. And then I was given an opportunity to go speak at Summer Strong in 2019. And one of the things I knew I wanted to do because he was battling right then. And something that I always share is you should share your scars, because then you afford people of the same to be able to feel like they can share about theirs. And a lot of our scars we can't see, right? Like you're talking about brain stuff and leukemia. Like we don't know necessarily what's happening in our body. We don't know why we get it, but it happens. And when you come out on the other side of it, you better believe you're going to connect with other people and help them through that as well. So he was going through it and his whole thing was Light Giver. And it's funny because it's like that is him to a T. All he did was care about other people and being able to pour into those other people. So when I spoke at Summer Strong, instead of having like a moment of silence for people to reflect upon him, I was like, we should have a moment of strength. And we did just like a stand up and like audible clap in the space, because I'm a big believer, kind of like your action board of the energy we put out into the world is what we're going to get back from it. And, you know, I'm very, very sad to know that he's not with us, but the number of people he's impacted that now are reconnecting, like how many stories have you had with Derek recently? You know, I think that that's pretty special to speak to someone's legacy. Yeah. So, I wish his family all the best too.
I mean, they always talk about like the mark of a man is not, you know, what he did, but more importantly, how he influences others.
Yeah.
And the analogy I think about constantly is like how big of a rock can you throw in a comp pool? You know, you think about like a little pebble and you see little kind of this, yeah. You put a big splash and all of a sudden that echoes for eternity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the greatest compliment you can pay somebody is they were a big rock and they put out a big splash. And to have that many people come forward with moments, you know, just goes to show that, like, you know, I mean, how impactful. But what's cool is how all of these high level throwers that I've been fortunate enough, we've been fortunate enough to connect through Sornex. Like, I didn't know these guys. Like, I didn't know Sornex. I met Bert. We actually in the elevator when I got invited to compete in the CrossFit Games. So I was getting ready to go play for the Patriots, and they invited me to compete in the CrossFit Games, and I was like, sure, I'll show up and win this thing. Like 312 pounds, you know. I didn't know what it was. I'd never done CrossFit, but like if somebody's
you didn't know they ran.
Well, I didn't know they ran far. I was real good at sprinting. I wasn't good at running distance, but they like hit me up and was like, hey, and I was like, sure, I will. What do you mean? I'll fucking show up and win this thing. Yeah. Like, which is my delusional mentality. Like if somebody's competing, I'm going to win. And,
okay, Abby Wambach.
Yeah, seriously. Like I remember at one point being like, I think I'm going to punch her just to see what happens and see if I could just knock her out.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure if I punched her, she would have fucking fought me.
1,000%.
Yeah.
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 I don't know who would have won. I'm not going to speak to that.
I think I was bigger than her.
She
definitely would have beat up Turley.
Yeah.
Kyle was one of our training partners and she would have whooped his ass. Yeah, like the
meeting throwers.
So I meet Bert in the elevator going up at the out in Aromas. We're like walking up in the elevator, and I can see this dude rubbernecking me. And it wasn't until like years later when I met Bert. I think we taught a seminar, or we got connected. I forgot how it was.
CSCCA 2016, and then podcast.
Yeah, naturally. And then he tells me, he's like, hey, I rode up in the elevator with you, and I was like, I fucking remember that dude rubbernecking me. He's like, yeah, I thought I was feeling pretty good. I was feeling pretty big at like 250, and all of a sudden you step on it like legitimately. He's like, what'd you weigh? I'm like, I was 317 or 315 or something. And he's like, holy shit. Like it was like
– You two were the only dudes over 6 feet.
And the only people over 200 pounds. So they showed up, and the next biggest guy was like 175, and I was like 308 or something, and I was like, oh fuck, they're gonna kill me. And I'm like chasing these little dudes through the mountains, and I'm like, fuck, this didn't end. But I finished like, I think it's 70 out of 200 people, which
I have to go to the record book. Yeah,
it was fact somewhere. I believe me, I was in the top 100. I know that. I made it to the end. Other people quit. I didn't quit. It's cool to hear these guys all connected because of him and Jed Logan and that. And that's, man, I mean, it's a great compliment. Yeah. And at the end of the day, like, as my dad used to tell me, nobody's getting out of this thing alive.
Yep.
So, you know, how people remember you and more importantly, you know, how people cherish your name is so important.
Yeah, the echoes in eternity. It's like the quote is, what we do in life echoes in eternity. It's actually tattooed on my chest, with an infinity symbol through my heart, because I think if you lead with your heart when you're meeting people, that impact, like they're going to remember that. How many athletes have you coached and they don't know how to write a program, but they remember who you are?
Sure.
So I think that's a lasting impact that we all get to make. But it even goes beyond that. I think as we kind of mature in age too, how many coaches have you been able to impact, and not just athletes, right? And a lot of the work you guys do is educating coaches, but it's also growing that community.
Megan, you dropped in on 2019 symposium. Hmm. And that was probably our best run and most impactful moment.
It was by far the most stressful symposium we'd ever had.
Exactly.
but it was good. It was excellent.
Yeah.
Why was it so stressful?
It's just a lot. So we always had this idea for every symposium that it had to be bigger and better. Mm. And so all of a sudden we had like three locations. There was like 20 speakers and like it was just, there was a lot of moving pieces and like everything from like different venues and here and not getting, I mean, like there was a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes for us to pull it off.
And I mean, the challenge that we put forth to us as coaches, we had 1, 2, 3, 4 coaches leading 175 athletes during the same warm up and then workout. I'm going to highlight some of that at the my NSCA talk tomorrow. But yeah, it was.
And you didn't hire an event staff to help run it.
No, well, we did. No, we did hire an event planner who proved to, who kind of sold us on a bag of goods that they were going to be able to do a lot more than they did. And we ended up like in typical status, like the ball got dropped and we had to like
pick it up and run with it.
And then, you know, and then the fact that we had all those Talk to Me Johnnies where like pretty much it's like, we're just going to put you on stage. And I had to interview all those people for 2 years in a row.
500 podcasts, John. Yeah. That's how many it
but
takes. It,
like there was just a lot, you know, and then my favorite piece is like, we're out there and like, we decided to have a pancake breakfast. And next thing you know, like, hey, you got to cook pancakes. So I'm out there literally before the talk, like making people pancakes. So like me and Chef Lewis are out there cooking pancakes. And I'm like, so like, not only did I go and interview people, we're running all this stuff. I'm out here cooking pancakes too. It was just, which I do. I love making pancakes. So that was actually the highlight. But
so the next one's bigger and better then.
Well, we decided what was wild is like, we were like, how do we how do we make this thing bigger?
Yep.
And then COVID hit and we were like, oh, thank God. We don't have to do it.
Yeah.
And then within this year, we just did the collective, which was neat. We just made it more of like about our coaches, our block one coaches, and
cool.
brought them in instead of like highlighting outside people.
Yeah.
But we did have Derek come, which was cool.
Yeah. And we tapped into people that are doing amazing things.
Yep.
That connected through our network.
Yep.
And then put them on stage and help them craft presentation. Many was their first opportunity to speak.
Oh, wow.
And as John gave me my first opportunity to speak, hell, teaching and coaching, mentoring, it's that's what it's all about. So it was cool to see them evolve into
share.
That same role.
Yeah, and share. I mean, it was wild. Like with three of the guys that submitted had like a similar story. Was it three or four?
Three.
Yeah, three of the guys had like kind of a similar addiction coming out the other side and like now hear how they're helping it. And these guys all came up and gave their stories that were all kind of similar. And then we kind of put them on a panel and allowed them. And it was really neat to see them like that growth of like, hey, this is who I was. And like, I think a lot of times with those kind of like early, maybe like trials and tribulations or maybe those negativity, like, you know, people tend to hide from it. Like these dudes owned it. Like I was a piece of shit. I was doing drugs, you know, this. And like, this is what it taught me. This is where I hit. And this is where I've transformed. And like every one of them owned it, which I was like, fuck.
Well, I mean, yeah, if you avoid your weaknesses, you're never going to get anywhere. Right.
God, sometimes like
it's hard.
It's yeah. No, like I sat there listening to it and being like, fuck, man, like I think with some things like, you know, like maybe things, you know, deep down, it's hard to like share those things and like kind of put them out there. And like those guys did it. And I was so proud of them.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's part of like the whole culture of what's happening of sharing depression within pro sports and the conversation around PTSD, with it, whether it's military or otherwise, like that conversation has changed a lot. But to your point, when people share those experiences, you know, there's three other people in the room that then felt validated for what they were doing and stayed the course because of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's what it's all about. To your point of, at the end of the day, like I love the book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Like there's nothing you can go through that someone hasn't been through.
Yeah.
You just haven't met them yet.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm pretty stubborn. So it took something for me. It took something called cancer for me to be ready to change. Does that make sense?
Man, my dad passed away from cancer. And it ate him to the bone in probably 2 months. And like we have a cancer charity with Wade's Army that, you know, we raise money for neuroblastoma because I mean, like seeing it attack little kids. Like I like one of my girls go to one of their friends at school. They're 10. Her younger sister, we just got yesterday, they put her on hospice. She got some rare brain cancer. And like a year ago, we were at a birthday party and I met, you know, like saw the girls and knew her. And then all of a sudden my wife showed her this picture. And I'm like looking at this and they're like, you know, they're she's in hospice, you know, her time is near. And you're like, little kid, like I, like my dad was 80.
Yeah.
Like I saw it eat him to the bone. It was fucking awful to sit there, but like he had an amazing life. Like seeing little kids at 18 months in this, like I can't make sense of it.
No.
And it's fucking awful. And it steals our loved ones from us.
Yep.
And so like when I hear, you know, things like diet, exercise, training, or anything we can do, and I'm like, you know, anything that we can do, I think as humans, we try to like make some sense of it. And then you realize like,
can't.
Nah, there's no sense for this shit.
Yeah.
Like we're here. You know, and nobody gets to decide how long we get to be here, and all this stuff is fucking awful.
And you can train and you can do all that other stuff and you still get something that you don't see coming. But the whole point of training isn't the training. It's so you're prepared when something happens. And I 100% believe I was in the best shape of my life 2014. And I was like, had I not done that, I don't know that I'd be here. So the whole fact of like choosing struggle is still something like I seek out, whether it's something as simple as getting in Lake Washington right now because it's freezing or, you know, training hard. That intensity factor of struggle is something that I seek because it's like you never know what's coming and it's good to know you can do it.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you've never done the work and you're in the heavyweight fight of your life,
yeah,
you know, have you done what's required of you for it? No, man, it's crazy. Yeah. Like I said, I didn't know Judd Logan. I just know him, you know, secondhand from what Bert, but people that I respect and people that I count as friends and like I have a ton of admiration for, when they pay somebody that much respect, like I'm sad I didn't get a chance to meet him.
Yeah.
So.
R.I.P.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm good to end it there, man. That was, dude, good. Thank you so much. Yeah. That was awesome.
Thank you, Megan.
And thanks for tuning in to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. Bye.
Now it's time for you to empower your performance. You can find Coach Megan Young on Instagram at coach_megastrong. Until next time, bye!
Drop on, drop on, drop on. Kick the wheels right before the hammer strikes.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.